Hello and welcome back to the Skatonauts podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the author, journalist and filmmaker John Ronson, a writer who spent his career exploring the anxieties, obsessions and oddities that sit just behind the surface of modern life. Known for exploring the strangest corners of human behaviour with humour and empathy, he's the writer behind the best-selling books The Psychopath Test, So You've Been Publicly Shamed and The Men Who Stare at Goats. Whether he's looking at cults, internet pylons or the psychology of fear and belonging, his work is often about identity, how we see ourselves, how others see us, and what happens when those versions collide. We'll be talking about the records that shaped him, the emotional pull of music, and how art helps us make sense of the parts of ourselves we don't always understand. You can watch video clips from the conversation over on our YouTube channel at Scared to Dance, and if you're listening, please do like, subscribe, and leave us a review, as it really helps the show. Hi John, how are you today?
I am very well, thank you, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Now, you've DJed at Scared to Dance many times, and looking at your last playlist, we had My Bloody Valentine, The Breeders, Television, Roxy Music, Grimes, Prom Scream, The Clash, Talking Heads. How do you go about choosing the songs you're going to play at the club?
And you missed out a couple of curveballs. I had some Kendrick Lamar, some Azealia Banks. Yeah, 212. But that's not a curveball. Everyone loves that song. So I'm thinking when I come back in May, I might try and put some Doechii in there because I'm a Doechii fan. Well, how do I come to choose? The first time, I've only DJed, I think, twice at your place, if I remember. Then I've done a couple of other Scared to Dance-related things. I remember the first time I was playing, like, I really was playing some experimental stuff. I was playing, like, Fugazi and Suicidal Tendencies and bands like that. And, you know, people were, like, gamely dancing. And then when my slot was over and you came on, you're stuck on Love Cats by The Cure. And the dance floor was just like flooded with grateful. I thought, oh, so if I'm stuck on The Cure, I just thought that's a little too easy. So that made me laugh. I always remember that. So I guess that answers my question. You know, I'm cognizant, as you are, of the fact that people want the classics like Love Cats and, you know, the very easy stuff, you know, Wet Leg, I suppose, counts. But I'm also very, I don't want to, you know, one doesn't want to pander too much. You want to try and put some, you know, put some interesting stuff in there too. Not that The Cure and, you know, when I say interesting, I mean less obvious.
Yes. Well, I was talking to someone about this the other day, actually, and they were asking me about how you plan a DJ set, and I did say I try and sneak in as much obscure stuff as I can, but whilst being aware to keep a dance floor alive.
Yeah. A lot of it's also down to like rabbit holes. And what I've noticed with me in music is that I get completely obsessed by something and I just listen over and over again and I go down a rabbit hole and I just, you know, until I'm, and the reason why I mentioned Doechii is because I'm doing that with Doechii right now. And then I kind of burn out. I think, oh my God, I never want to hear Kim Yudorfson again. And so sometimes when I DJ for you, I happen to be down down one of those rabbit holes. And then a lot of my set will be based on that.
So is there anything in the DJ set that you'd been listening to when you were growing up in Cardiff?
The Specials, all that sort of ska revival stuff I was a huge fan of growing up. So yeah, all of that stuff, The Specials, The Fun Boy Free, The Selector, I think I played on my radio last time. So definitely the ska stuff, definitely some anything, any kind of post-punk stuff, that was the stuff that I grew up being obsessed with.
Well, one of the times you created our film night, you chose Dance Craze, which is a concert film featuring performances with The Specials, Madness,
yes.
Selector, The Beat. And when we were doing the Q&A on stage, you told me a brilliant story about meeting Terry Hall.
Yes. So when I must have been 12, it was 1979, it was probably the second or third gig I'd ever been to. There was a club in Cardiff called Sophia Gardens, and my mother was quite permissive, actually. She allowed me to kind of go off on my own and see shows that I think other mothers would have thought were quite dangerous. And so she dropped me off at Sapphire Gardens, and I saw, well, the most memorable was The Specials. And I decided, I had a brainwave, I decided to try and to pretend to faint, like noticeably faint. So they'd lift me up and put me on the side of the stage to watch the show. And it worked. It worked. Everything that I hoped for happened. I pretended to faint. The bouncers lifted me up, put me on the side of the stage. They didn't make me go to the back of the auditorium, which is what I think probably usually happens in situations like this. So I'm standing on the side of the stage, and Terry Hall came up to me. This was just before the band was supposed to go on. And Terry Hall came up to me and said, like, are you okay? And I said, are you in The Specials? And he said, I'm the singer. And I said, okay. And I think that was the entirety of our conversation. But I got to watch the entire show from the side of the stage, took all of these photos of Jerry Dammers, who was like posing for me, had a camera around my neck. And it was the greatest moment of my life up until that point, bar none. Years later, I mentioned it on Twitter, and Terry Hall invited me to see them play in New York. So I saw them at the end of a pier in somewhere in Manhattan. And then later on, when you hear the stories about how Terry Hall had been sexually abused as a young child, and it suddenly kind of made sense to me. I was a little kid on my own in this sketchy, you know, potentially risky situation. And he was making sure I was okay. He was like looking out for me.
Yeah. So why did you leave Cardiff to move to London?
The first minute I could. I would always go to London all the time. I'd get on a train and just get the train from Cardiff to London and then just lose myself in London. I'd get on a bus and just be on the bus until the bus conductor came to get my money, and then I'd jump off the bus because these were the buses that didn't have any doors, and then I'd just wait. I'd be somewhere in London and I'd get on another bus, and I would just do that all day, just lose myself in London, almost like a kind of twig in the tidal wave of the transport system. So I did that throughout my childhood whenever I got the chance, and then I actually moved to London in September 1985, when I was 18.
So you moved to study?
Yeah, I went to the Polytechnic of Central London.
And how was that? What were you listening to? Did you have external influences kind of steering you in certain directions?
When I was about 16, I can't remember how it happened, but I met this really kind of cool girl who was older than me, like an art student. And she invited me to stay with her in, she was at Bretton Hall in this art college up in, I think, Wakefield. And they were all taking hard drugs. I remember that. They were all taking heroin. And I didn't. But she was going off and sort of leaving me in her dorm room. And there was a copy of Here Come the Warm Jets by Brian Eno there. I really associate listening to Here Come the Warm Jets with that moment of my life when I was a bit like seeing Specials at Sapphire Gardens, this moment when you're Alice going through the looking glass, you're a suburban kid getting to see the world for the first time. So when I first moved to London, I definitely, early Brian Eno was a huge influence for that reason. I got obsessively into Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. Listened to him like constantly. There was a pretty obscure Jonathan Richman album called Rocking and Romance, which most people don't know. And I'm not even sure you can get it anymore. I think it was on Rough Trade and I don't think it's ever been re-released. You can still get it on YouTube. But there's a song called The Beach. The Beach being one of the best things we got. Well, it's not what you got on. It's not what you got on. It's what you got. Not got, so I can't remember. It's what you have not. And I used to listen to Rockin' and Romance all the time. And then a couple of years later, I'm skipping ahead for a second, a couple of years later, I became the social secretary of the Polytechnic of Central London. I got to book the bands for a year, and I booked Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers for the opening night, like the big freshers party. And it was so good. And you can, there's bootlegs of that concert on, online.
Did you meet him?
Yeah. And we had a fight. Well,
Jonathan Richman seems like quite a kind of placid kind of guy.
Well, you'd think. And it, I think in many ways he is. But so the first thing that happened was, well, the place was packed. Everyone was saying to me, this is a terrible idea. No one cares about Jonathan Richman. Pick someone else for your Freshers' Fair, your Freshers' Ball. And I was like, no, I want the Modern Lovers. And I got the timing, I was right. I got the timing really right. And the place was packed, both with students and outsiders. I think it was open to the public. Anyway, it was packed. And I remember there was a little kid, like a sort of 5 or 6 year old kid there. And I went up to Jonathan Richman and said, do you mind if there's a little kid? Can he watch the show from the side of the stage? And Jonathan Richman went, there's a little kid here. Modern Lovers, let's get out and play that now. We don't want to keep any kids waiting. So they went out and played the show. And so that was very nice. But at the end of the show, there was a little bit of a crush. What happened was, I don't know if you know this, but Jonathan Richman used to play very quietly. He didn't have amps. He would just have the on-stage monitors. And everybody would have to listen for the on-stage monitors, which frankly was a shit idea. And couple that with the fact that the room was packed, there was a crush. And there was like danger of people getting hurt at the front. And after the show, Jonathan Richman sort of shouted at me for letting in too many people. And I shouted back at him for playing too quietly. And so we had this sort of fight. And I, you know, I'm 18 or probably 19 years old now. And I'm fighting with like my hero. But you know what? Looking back on it now, we were both in the wrong.
Have you met him since?
No, I don't think I ever have.
I remember he played a bunch of gigs at the Amersham Arms. It was probably about 10 years ago. I think he did like 3 nights. It was just like the most random thing. Like, why is Jonathan Richman playing at the Amersham Arms in New Cross?
Right. Well, one thing I was very lucky for, when he plays completely alone, was he completely alone then?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, never as good. You really want the backing vocals. You know, one of the best things about Jonathan Richman is the harmonies. And when I booked him, he had these two backing singers. It was acoustic, a bit like the sort of Violent Femmes type setup, like acoustic drums, if I remember rightly. And but the harmonies were amazing, and it was a great gig.
So around this time, you're 18, 19, are you going to clubs?
Yes, I'm going to a lot of shows. Thank you for asking me these questions, by the way. There's almost nothing I would rather be talking about than these questions. I went to a lot of clubs. Gosh. What I remember, there was a club in Camden I used to go to a lot. What I remember better, though, is the gigs I went to. And they were incredible. At that period, between about the ages of 18 and 21, I saw Tom Waits at the Dominion Theatre doing Rain Dogs, the Rain Dogs tour. Funny story about that. So I turn up, and I don't think I had a ticket. I thought I was just going to try and get in. So I turn up, and no, you can't come in without a ticket. And then somebody said to me, you know, come this way. And they let me in, and I stood up on the balcony because I didn't have a seat, all the seats were full. And I watched the whole show, and somebody came up to me. The person who wouldn't let me in came up to me and said, oh, I'm so sorry, mate. Like, if I'd known it was you, I'd have let you in, or something along those lines. And I was like a 19-year-old, like totally unknown person. God knows what happened, but somebody must have told the bouncer that I like deserved to be there. Anyway, that's a weird thing that I've always remembered. Tom Waits, I saw the Pogues play St. Patrick's Night at the Town and Country Club with Kirsty MacColl and Joe Strummer playing. Those are probably the two. Oh, I remember seeing the Cardiacs play in Soho at like maybe the 100 Club or the Marquee. Those are the most memorable. I mean, to see Tom Waits and the Pogues with Kirsty MacColl and Joe Strummer in the mid-80s, when both bands, I think, both were at their absolute apex, was incredible.
So around this time, between the gap between studying and then you started writing for Time Out, How did you start writing for them?
Okay, so what happened was, so after a year or two of college, I became the social secretary. I got voted in and became the social secretary. I did a comedy show. I introduced comedy to the college, which had never happened before. I started a night called Frank's Wild Tuesdays, based on Tom Waits' Frank's Wild Years.
So did your book?
Everyone. My comedy booking was better than my music booking. My music booking was a bit shit. Nothing particularly memorable. But my comedy booking, I had everyone. They deny this, and I've had the conversation with them, but I would place my hand on my heart and say, I booked Vic Reeves before he was with Bob Mortimer. So Vic on his own. And both Vic and Bob have told me that could not have happened. That didn't happen. I imagined it. But I am certain that I had Vic Reeves before Bob Mortimer was on the scene.
That was also in South London, wasn't it? I think that was also New Cross.
Yeah. I used to go to the Tunnel Club. Do you remember the Tunnel Club? Malcolm Hardy's Tunnel Club. I used to go there and it was so rowdy. Malcolm Hardy would piss on the audience. I saw that happen. I saw Malcolm Hardy. Someone was like, Malcolm, piss on the audience. And he gets his dick out and pisses on the audience. And people loved it. I remember seeing, it was either Linda Smith or Hattie Hayridge. I wish I could remember which one it was, at the Tunnel Club. And I saw her. I think it was Hattie Hayridge. And for some reason, she came up to me and we were talking. Because I was like a 19-year-old kid, like just totally unknown. And she looked rattled. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, I was just on stage and everyone was going like, you know, just, you know, the most sort of misogynistic heckles, you know, get off the stage, you can't, all this kind of stuff. And she left because the Tony Club was like famous for like its brutality. And she got off the stage and some bloke came up to her. This is the story she told me. Some bloke came up to her and said, oh, that's completely out of order what just happened to you. You know, all of those sort of misogynist heckles, you know, that cunt. I would never do that. And she said, you didn't yell out cunt? And he went, no, no, no. He said, I'm the one who yelled out, burn the witch. I always remember that. So I started hanging out with this really good comedian called James McCarbra, who used to hang out with Joe Brand. And I'll tell you who writes a lot about this time. Alan Davis. That's his name, right? I've sort of had a brain freeze. Jonathan Creek, Alan Davis, yeah. His new memoir, he writes a lot about sort of being on the comedy circuit in the mid-80s and, you know, James McCarbra and Joe Brand and that whole crowd. And I was very... So I became like part of that crowd. James McCarbra sort of took me under his wing. And so I was hanging out with Joe Brand and that crowd. And I tell you, a big memory from that time was Mark Thomas came up to me and said, you know, what are you doing? You're always just like hanging around, you know, you're just like, you're just hanging around in the background. When are you going to do something? When are you going to stop hanging around and do something? I remember Mark Thomas said that to me. Yeah, I've mentioned it to him a few times, like in subsequent years. I think I've thanked him a couple of times for that. I'll tell you who else I used to go and see back then. John Otway and Wild Willie Barrett. I saw them a bunch of times. Actually, no, just John Otway. He'd split up with Wild Willie Barrett by then. You know, Beware of the Flowers, because I'm sure they're going to get you, yeah, and Really Free. I used to go and see him a lot. So I booked all of them for Frank's Wild Tuesdays, and it was like a big hit at college. But while I was doing all of that, I got friends with Frank Sidebottom, who I booked, and this band, The Man from Del Monte, who's just reformed. Actually, they're a brilliant band. If people really should listen to them, they're brilliant. Very much in the mould of, I guess, the Monochrome Set and the C86 type music. And I became, at the same time, Frank Sidebottom invited me to move to Manchester to be his agent and his keyboard player. And the Man from Del Monte invited me to Manchester to manage them.
Didn't you replace Mark Radcliffe? Yeah.
Yeah, Mark Radcliffe had a sort of bout of illness, and so I replaced him as keyboard player, and then Mark Radcliffe rejoined the band on accordion, so I wasn't fired. Mark Radcliffe was the accordion player and I was the keyboard player, and Mark Riley was around, and Chris Evans was around. He was the driver for a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This didn't make the film.
Yeah, no, it didn't. There's a story that Frank's manager used to always tell about Chris Evans. He was driving and he pulled up on the Edgware Road. The band were all in the back of the transit van, you know, Frank Sidebottom and everyone in the back of a transit van. And Chris Evans pulled up on Edgware Road and wound down the window and said to a passerby, said, "Excuse me." And I said, "Yeah." And Chris Evans said, "Is this London?" And the guy said, "Yeah." And Chris Evans said, "Well, where do you want this wood?" That makes me laugh. So I moved to Manchester, played with Frank Sidebottom for a couple of years, managed Manfred Diamante for a couple of years. I was there for the whole Manchester thing because I moved to Manchester in about 87 or 88. And a year later, Manchester hit. So I was at all the shows. I went to see the Stone Roses at Spike Island. I saw the Stone Roses and the Happy Mondays play together. I was at the big G-Max Happy Monday show. All the big kind of iconic Manchester shows I went to. I became good friends with Matt Squire, who was John Squire for the Stone Roses' brother. So I used to go with Matt to all the shows. So to live through Manchester, like one minute Manchester's this kind of urban wasteland, and the next minute everybody's, you know, looks like Height Ashbury in 1969.
So what else were you listening to outside of Manchester?
Yeah, I used to go to Indie Night. Thursday night at the Hacienda was Indie Night, so I would go on Thursday night, yeah. Everybody else was going to like the kind of Balearic Beats night on like Monday from Wednesday nights. The cool night, when people think about the cool Hacienda, I think about Wednesday and Friday and Saturday nights. But student night was a Thursday night, and that was the night I used to go to the Hacienda. I'll tell you what was a really huge pivotal album for me back then was Henry's Dream by Nick Cave. Papa Won't Leave You, Henry. The first three songs on Henry's Dream, Papa Won't Leave You, Henry, I Had a Dream, Joe, and Straight to You, just, you know, blew me away and made me a kind of lifelong Nick Cave fan. And then a little bit later on, actually, the other band that really kind of got into my mind and I thought kind of was a very good, like when you're down, was Belle and Sebastian. Listening to If You're Feeling Sinister, kind of all of Belle and Sebastian, to be honest. I don't really differentiate between albums. Judy and the Dream of Horses in particular, kind of really, I must listen to that 1,000 times. Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense as well. That was another thing that I listened to over and over again.
Well, we were very lucky to have Stuart Murdoch on the first ever episode of the Scared Tonics podcast. So if anyone missed that, that was episode one. And Stuart's a really lovely guy.
Yeah, I'm going to go and see them.
Well, just going back to Frank Sidebottom, just for those younger listeners who may not know who Frank Sidebottom was. So my experience of Frank Sidebottom was growing up in the 80s and 90s, seeing this odd man on TV with a papier-mâché head, with a very nasally voice. And like most things on TV in the 90s, I would have been about, I don't know, 10 maybe, when I probably first saw Frank Sidebottom on TV. You just thought, what on earth is going on? And how is this on TV? So how was it like being in his band?
I mean, it was incredible. Both the things I was doing in Manchester, managing Manfred Diamante and playing with Frank Sidebottom, were incredible. Again, they were both at their zenith. I've been really lucky to be places where people were at their very best.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been in a lot of right places at right time.
I really was. Well, there's another one when I moved back down to London, because when I moved back down to London after a few years in Manchester, Manchester had just ended in a blaze of gunfire and drug overdoses and robberies. I moved to London, and straight away Britpop happened. So I was there for all of that. I was there for Blur. I went to, you know, see, you know, maybe we'll get onto that in a minute. But yeah, Big and Frank's band was brilliant. He was such a fantastically mysterious, interesting character.
How was he off stage?
Well, some of my favourite moments was when he'd keep the head on for like all, because that was so like, you know, in the movie that I wrote with Peter Strawn, our Frank kept the head on the whole time. But in real life, sometimes he kept the head on and sometimes he didn't. And when he did, you had to call him Frank. He wouldn't answer to Chris. And you know, as I said in the book I wrote to go alongside the movie, nothing makes a young man feel more alive and on an adventure than cruising down the motorway at 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting next to a man wearing a big fake head. Alice in Wonderland.
How was your experience of co-writing that film?
That was great.
How did it come about?
So 20 years later, or even more, I was at the park in Islington with my son, who must have been like a little boy at the time, and hadn't spoken to Chris CV, Frank Sidebottom, in, you know, years. And my phone rings and this voice goes, "Hello." And I said, "Frank?" He goes, "Oh, yes." I said, "Frank, can I speak to Chris?" And he went, "Hang on a minute." And he went, "Hello." Yeah. And he said that he was reforming the band. He'd been working as an animator on Pingu, but he was now wanted to be Frank Sidebottom again. He hadn't been Frank Sidebottom in years. And did I want to write something about my time in the band as kind of, you know, to help him relaunch Frank Sidebottom? So it took me 2 days. I wrote this, usually I take way longer, but I just sort of blasted out all of my memories of being in Frank Sidebottom's band, and I went in The Guardian. And at the time, Peter Strawn, the screenwriter, was writing the screenplay for The Men Who Stare at Goats, and he read my thing. So I was talking to him most days, and he read it, and he told me that he'd always wanted to write a fake biopic. He always had this idea of writing a movie. What if Captain Beefheart had been around in the 1950s? How would the world have perceived Captain Beefheart? And he said, but your idea is better. And I had no idea what he meant by that. But I think what he meant, somebody joins a band where the singer wears a big fake head that he never takes off. So me and Peter started writing Frank together, and that's how that happened.
The film had a really studied cast with Michael Fassbender, Domhnall Gleeson, Maggie Gyllenhaal. What did you make of the film adaptation?
I liked it a lot, actually. Every so often, maybe once every 2 years, I'll show it somewhere. I live in this little village in upstate New York now, and there's this fantastic sort of arts centre. You know, we live in right in the middle of nowhere, but one of my neighbours has a sort of camping site and with a little arts centre, so I showed it there quite recently. So I watch it every few years, and I have like different feelings about it each time I watch it. The last time when I saw it last summer, I thought, God, Maggie Gyllenhaal's really good in this film. Like I'd never really thought about her performance before, and I realised just how good she was. So yeah, I like it a lot. It's not a Frank Sidebottom film. So I think that kind of pissed off a few sort of hardcore Sidebottom fans. Yeah. Not Chris himself. I mean, Chris had died by then, but and I know he wouldn't have minded because I checked. I was like, what if this film becomes not a Frank Sidebottom movie or a Chris CV biopic? What if it becomes its own thing? And he was like totally fine with it, and his family were totally fine with it. And so I know the family didn't mind, but I think some of the people around him were probably a bit pissed off. Because we made our Frank this sort of amalgamation of all of these different outsider artists who were too sort of fantastically strange to make it in the mainstream. So Captain Beefheart, there's a lot of Daniel Johnson in our
Frank.
Yeah,
I was going to say Daniel Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, he's a very big part. He was the documentary, The Devil and Daniel Johnson.
You showed it at our film night.
Yes, and I love that film. That film inspired our Frank more than almost anything. So yeah, I think, and I loved working with Peter Storr. He's brilliant. He won an Oscar last year for Conclave. He wrote the screenplay for Conclave.
And also with The Men Who Stare at Goats, which had George Clooney in the lead. Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of how that process works when the rights are bought for one of your books? Do you have any say? Do you have to give up certain control?
Well, I kind of want to give up control because I think these days when one of my stories is, you know, in discussion for adaptation, I'm always there. But what I've realised is that I should be there just as like the conduit between the production and the real story. Like, that's my role. I don't want to get involved in casting. I don't want to get involved in like anything else, mainly because, you know, I sort of stay in your lane, you know, I sort of stick to the things you're good at. And so I tend to keep out of everything except for I'm there if anyone wants me, if anybody wants me for that singular purpose, like, you know, how do we adapt this thing into... So that's kind of always my role. What I've learned, because I've been involved now in three films that got made, The Men Who Stare at Goats, Frank, and Okja, the Bong Joon-ho
film. Oh, yeah,
film.
I remember seeing that at the cinema, yeah.
Yeah, I co-wrote Okja with Bong Joon-ho. And in terms of films getting made, one thing gets a film made. This is what I've learned. Actually, funnily enough, when The Men Who Stare at Goats was being developed, I made this documentary called Stanley Kubrick's Boxes about Okay, so at one point I met the head of Warner Brothers. I think he was the head of Lee or some head of Warner Brothers. And I said to him, his name was Rick Sennett, and I said to him, it looks like I wrote this book called The Men Who Stare at Goats, and it looks like it's, you know, might be turned into a movie. And he went, this kind of grizzled old guy, he went, John, okay, this is what you need to know about Hollywood. And in Hollywood, no film ever gets made. That was it. But, you know, that's good advice. I think that's basically true. But the reason why those three films got made was for one reason. This is my wisdom about how films get made. You need one. There's a phrase in, I don't know if the phrase is still there, but there used to be this phrase about, do they move the needle? Are they needle movers? You need one person involved in a film who Hollywood has decreed moves the needle, like gets things greenlit. And in The Men Who Stare at Goats, it was George Clooney. In Frank, it was Michael Fassbender. And in Okja, it was Bong Joon-ho. And that's why, there's no other reason why those films got made. You need one person who's like an A-list person, who's A-list enough to get things greenlit. And that's how films get made. Nothing else does it. That's certainly in my experience.
Are there any of your other books that you think would lend themselves well to the big screen? 'Cause I really love Them. I remember reading that quite early on.
Well, Them was kind of the one that got away because, oh my God, it had a good... This kind of breaks my heart a little bit. When I tell you who was attached to be in the film adaptation of Them, Edgar Wright was going to direct it. Mike White had written the screenplay of White Lotus, you know, The White Lotus. And Reese Witherspoon and Jack Black were both attached to star in it. And there's an example of something, every one of those four people moved the needle, but somebody high up at the film company just said, nah. And with a wave of their hand, it went away.
Wow. How far in development did it get? Was it just...
Mike White had written a screenplay, I think just the first draft screenplay.
Yeah.
And I think that was it. But they were all up for it. Jack Black was saying to Mike White, they just made School of Rock together, so they were close. And he was saying, you know, when are we going to do this? Let's get this made. And it would have been great. It would have been a great film.
Yeah,
that's kind of heartbreaking.
Are there any of your other books?
Well, they've all been, you know, they've all been optioned. And
they have been optioned.
Most of them, yeah, at one time or another. The Psychopath Test is still bubbling along as a possibility. That still may get made. The show I made for Audible, The Debutantes, that's still a possibility. So there's always a few things bubbling along. I basically, as I say, I think my role is to be there if they want me, but not to be there, sort of rolling up my sleeves and hustling to make it happen.
So I just wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about how you became a writer, and also when certain books are broken out more into the mainstream, how that is for a writer.
Sure. Well, I became a writer. I was living in Manchester. Well, the first thing that happened was when I was at college, Polytechnic of Central London, I was writing for McGarrell, which was the college newspaper. And David Cardiff, who was one of the lecturers there and was married to Lynn Barber, the great journalist, everybody was like in awe of David Cardiff, partly because he was incredibly handsome and charismatic and funny and kind of charming, but also because he was married to Lynn Barber, who, you know, at the time and to this day is like a hero to people like me, sort of narrative nonfiction writers. She was just amazing, still is. David Cardiff died quite young, but Lynn Barber still kicking. And David Cardiff took me to a coffee shop on Ridinghouse Street and said, "You're the only person who writes for McGarrell who knows how to write." And I thought, well, I'd better be a writer then. Like, this was the first time anybody had ever really given me a really big steer. And then when I moved to Manchester, I was in Frank Sidebottom's band. I always remember Mike Doherty, the manager, saying to me, "You're not cut out for the music business, John. You're going to end up being some kind of writer." And then the Man from Del Monte were all writing in their spare time for City Life, which was Manchester's time out. And so I started writing for City Life, basically for free sandwiches at the film previews at the Corner House. And I wouldn't say that I particularly loved it. You know, as a young person, what you really love is like, driving up the motorway at 3 a.m. with a band, you know, sitting on your own, writing and chain smoking is much less fun. So at the beginning, it was more a kind of practical decision. It's like, for some reason, I can do this. And people are complimenting me and people are offering me work. So, because that's what happened, I started working for the radio in Stockport. Terry Christian, just before he went on to present The Word, had me as his sidekick on this local radio show in Manchester, in Stockport, KFM. And we did the late night show. It was me and Terry Christian. And do you know who our co-presenters were for the evening night show? Craig Cash and Caroline Ahern. So Craig would do, and then Terry Christian left to do The Word. And so it was like, Craig Cash would be 7 till 10. I would be 10 till 1 in the morning. And Caroline Ahern would be 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. And sometimes we sort of mixed it up that I would co-present with Craig and sometimes he would do my slot and I'd do his. But basically, that was us, Craig, me and Caroline. So I watched Craig and Caroline become a sort of unit and then they went off and did Mrs. Merton and the Royal Family. And then we were all fired. We were all fired. And because a new programme controller came in and wanted to make the station more mainstream because we were just playing Manchester. We were at the radio station at the heart of Manchester. So the Inspiral Carpets and the World of Twist and all these bands would like come in all the time. And I would also play a lot of American stuff like the Pixies and the Violent Femmes and that kind of stuff. And we were beloved by a small audience. But really loved by a small audience. And so a new program controller came in and fired us all. And to answer the question that you asked about an hour ago, that's how I ended up working the time out. Because for some reason, there was a kind of campaign to get me and Craig reinstated. Because Caroline was like the 1 a.m. till 4 a.m, so she'd sort of slipped through the cracks a little bit. But me and Craig had become like the sort of voice, the sort of face of this radio station. So there was a big campaign to get us reinstated. And between the stuff I was writing, I was writing bits and pieces for The Guardian and The Sunday Correspondent. And time out, for some reason, the editor sort of noticed me and offered me a column. Victor Lewis Smith had been the columnist, and he left and they offered me the column, partly because he'd seen that there was this big kind of noise up in Manchester about, you know, me being fired from this radio show and so on. So that's how I ended up writing for Time Out. So Manchester had just ended. People were getting shot. There was loads of robberies. And I just thought, oh, fuck that. And so I moved back to London and started working for Time Out.
So how did your first book happen?
My very first book was this pretty terrible book called Club Class. And it was just like a throwaway Christmas book. So that one doesn't count. My book then. Okay, so yeah, what happened was, on the back of the Time Out column, Janet Street Porter offered me a TV show for Def 2, BBC 2. And it was pretty bad. It was not a good show. I wasn't comfortable in front of the camera.
I'm not aware of this TV show. Can you explain?
It was kind of like, it was called The Ronson Mission. It was like a bit pranky, a little, you know, bit, well, when people, well, you know, there's a, it was a little Chris Morrissey, a little Louis Theroux-y. But actually before, like, I'm not claiming anything because Chris Morris and Louis Theroux both did a shit ton better than I did it in The Ronson Mission. But it was kind of before both of them came along, I think. Pranks. One of the pranks we did was I wrote this song. It was the time of celebrity charity pop videos. So I wrote this song, this kind of brutal far right wing vigilante song called Let's Stamp Out Crime by Any Means Necessary. I got a bunch of celebrities to sing it. You know, there's a lot of bad people about. so that was the kind of joke that we do. So we kind of pranked one of these like Brookside stars into singing this brutal right-wing song, Nicholas Parsons. So that
they did that on Brass Eye, didn't they?
I don't remember. They might have done.
Wasn't there a prank song, I think?
There might have been, but I am pretty sure that if that is the case, I'd have done it first. Like The Ronson Mission would have done it first.
Maybe it wasn't a song, maybe it was a campaign. But it was very similar of like, sort of duping celebrities into this very serious message that they clearly have not done any background reading on.
There was a cake, this drug.
That's
called cake.
The one.
And then there was also paedophiles. That paedophiles can let off a smell that comes through your computer and turns you into a paedophile or something along those lines. That's what Chris Morris was saying. That's the kind of thing I was doing. With also some more Louis Theroux-y type scenes in there too. But it wasn't good. I was too young. I was like early to mid-20s still. And I felt very uncomfortable turning up places with this giant TV crew. You know, back then you'd had to travel with like seven people. And I just thought, what the fuck am I doing? Like I'm not an actor, I'm a writer. So, but one of the very few, the two kind of legacies of The Ronson Mission, well, I wouldn't say legacies, the two good things that happened from it were, first, Louis Theroux was a big fan of it. And, you know, as I've kind of often said, that it was The Ronson Mission that sort of inspired him to want to do what he did. And then immediately did it a hell of a lot better than I'd done it on The Ronson Mission. And this Channel 4 commissioning editor called Peter Grimsdale bafflingly liked it. No one else did, so I don't know why he did. And he hooked me up with Fenton Bailey, from World of Wonder, who does all of... These days, Fenton's like a sort of, you know, mogul. Like, he does all of RuPaul's stuff and has, you know, got this like giant empire. But at the time, he was doing the Adam and Joe show, Adam Buxton, Joe Cornish, and he got me to do stuff. And so I started making stuff for Channel 4 with Fenton. And that's how I ended up writing my book then, because I turned... I turned some of the documentaries that I'd made for Channel 4 into chapters in the book, and then I kind of wrote more and more and more, and that's how my first book happened.
And you've always been fascinated with sort of outsiders. I wondered if that sort of fed into the kind of music you like. I was talking to someone the other day about indie music being music for outsiders. You know, we're all a bit awkward, we're all introverted, but some of us slightly extroverted as well in old ways, and it sort of comes out in different manners. So I was wondering if there was a link between the two for you.
Yeah, I think so. I've always, you know, I always remember, I've told this story before, but I was up for an award. I was making this show for Radio 4 called John Ronson On, and Adam and Joe were there. And we both, and it was at this big, you know, all in tuxedos at the Grosvenor House Hotel, and we both lost, you know, and I went outside for a cigarette and I saw Adam Buxton standing outside, and I was talking, and he said to me, John, you know why we always lose? And I was like, why? And he said, we're marginal. He said, we're marginal. And the people that we like are marginal. And I think he's right. Like, we're marginal and the people that we like are marginal. Which isn't to say, by the way, there's some mainstream people I love. I really love this whole rise of, you know, Olivia Rodrigo and Chapel Road and Sabrina Carpenter and Doechii and that whole crowd. So it's not like I stay away from the mainstream. Like, I love those people. I'll listen to those people all the time. So I do have mainstream tastes too, especially now, because I think what's happening in the mainstream now is like especially good. But I very often go back to the Moldy Peaches or the more kind of marginal stuff, the Violent Femmes and that kind of stuff. I listen to that a lot.
When you had broader success with the Psychopath Test, and so you've been publicly shamed, how was that for you? Did you feel like you were sort of, you know, you had this TV show that was, in your own words,
like, not marginal enough. I really did feel that way. I didn't feel it with the Psychopath Test. I remember feeling just very happy with the Psychopath Test. But So You've Been Publicly Shamed was like a sort of issue book in a way. Not that I really planned it that way, but it was taken that way. And so there was like all of these editorials. Was I right? Was I wrong? It sort of crashed into the culture in America in a big way. It didn't sell like a zillion books. It sort of did totally well enough, like, I'm not complaining. But mostly it was like culturally significant. And I felt unexpectedly, I really didn't like that. I really felt like my head was way too high above the parapet. I didn't like being discussed. I didn't like being turned into a kind of meme. Like, oh, you know, when's John Ronson going to cape up for this person? You know, because the book was about me defending people who were being unfairly publicly shamed. I found the whole thing like very uncomfortable. And I deliberately, I think after the success of Seeming Publicly Shamed, dialed it back, like started doing more marginal things again. Because I didn't like that. I didn't like it.
How did you deal with it at the time?
Sort of freaked out a bit. I was like fighting with people on Twitter, like trying to clear my name. like fat lot of good that does. No, so I made mistakes. Like, I shouldn't have ever tweeted. I should never have tweeted. I shouldn't have sent a single fucking tweet ever. I should never have been on Twitter, except for using it to like promote. So the only things I ever do on social media now is either promote my own work or promote somebody else's work if I think it's good. Like, you're not going to get any opinions out of me on social media anymore. My God, you're not. Weirdly, I didn't like it. It didn't sit comfortably with me at all, being well-known in that way.
You have a new book coming out later this year called The Castle. What can you tell us about that?
I'll tell you how it begins. I'm asleep and I wake up and there's a series of texts from my son. And I read the last text first. And the last text said something like, it's okay. That was completely fucked, but we managed to leave. We're okay now, or something like that. And it turns out that him and three friends had been invited to a party being held by a stranger that they'd met on Tinder. And when they got to the guy's house, it was a vast, vast newly built castle with like turrets and a moat and a drawbridge. Way too many turrets, like a shit ton of turrets. It looked like
too many turrets.
Yeah, it looked like the Disney castle if the person who designed the Disney castle had taken a load of acid. And and they went inside and there was no party. They'd been lured there for different reasons. So that's how the book starts. And then I then go to the castle to try and find out what's going on.
Sounds fantastic.
It's really, it's certainly a page turner. I'm really pleased with it. And I hope others are too. One thing I skipped by the way, before we end, I just wanted to say one other thing, because I said I was there for all of Manchester, but when I moved back to London, I was there for Britpop. And I just want to tell you this thing that happened. I got friendly. So that show, The Ronson Mission, which no one liked. Clearly, some people liked it, because I'll tell you who came up to me was... So Jamie Hewlett came up to me and said he was a fan of it. And so I became friends with him and Alex from Blur. And I was round at Alex's house, his flat above a bar called Freud's in Covent Garden on, I think, St. Martin's Lane, if I remember rightly. And Alex said, "You've got to hear this. We've just been in the studio. We've just recorded a new song. Do you want to be the first people ever to hear this new song?" And I was like, yeah. And he put it on and it was Parklife. So I heard Parklife the day it was written, the day it was recorded. So that's pretty cool. So I do feel very lucky that I got to experience Manchester and I got to experience Britpop. It was incredible, yeah.
Yeah, you clearly have a knack of just being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. I mean, since Britpop, it hasn't really happened since, but it only needs to happen twice.
Well, it's still a pretty good hit rate. I'm a big fan of your Radio 4 series, Things Fall Apart. Would there be any more?
Yep. Now that I've finished the book, The Castle, I'm making the third, probably final season of Things Fell Apart. We are 4 episodes in, and two more are nearly done. So I think we're on schedule for getting it finished. And I think it's good. I think it's working.
And are there any other projects that you're working on? Because it's been 11 years between books for you,
yeah.
Which is an unusually large gap. You've done radio shows and podcasts, The Debutante and so on.
Yeah, I sort of count The Debutante and The Butterfly Effect and The Last Days of August and Things Fell Apart as like kind of like books, just audio form. So even though it's 11 years, I've been working nonstop.
Why did they take those forms instead of books?
Honestly, there wasn't much appetite. I wanted to do something about the tech takeover of the porn industry. I was really interested in tech takeovers of industries. And I thought it'd be much more fun and odd to do the tech takeover of the porn industry instead of the tech takeover of, taxis or hotels or whatever, because it was happening all over with Uber and everything. But I thought, I want to do the porn industry. What are the consequences? This great flow of money has gone from the San Fernando Valley into the pocket of these 2 or 3 moguls who own Pornhub. What's that doing to people? What are the consequences? And there just wasn't much appetite for me to do it as a book. And Audible said, "We'll do it for us." So that's why I switched. And then I was having fun doing The Butterfly Effect. So I then made a sequel, The Last Days of August. And then I was just in the audio space, as we say in America, and so that's where the doors were open, and I was away for too long. I regret that a little bit. But also I care so much about books that I want them all to be just the best thing I can possibly do. So I don't want it. So I'm never going to just toss off a book. It has to really matter, and I think the cast, you want books to be like life-changing. I think them and The Psychopath Test and So You've Been Publicly Shamed were sort of life-changing in the way that my life changed during the writing of it and as a result of writing it. It has to be as huge as that, I think, to earn its place as a book. It has to be like, and so I would never just want to write another book. And I think The Castle is also life-changing in that way. It has to feel like just huge, you know, and I think it does too. So I think it's earned its place.
And you've done live events in the past for the Psychopath Test. Are you going to be doing any for The Castle?
Yes. So that answers the question. Like, between now and the autumn, all I'm going to be doing is finishing season 3 of Things Fell Apart and making my stage show for The Castle. Because I do pretty elaborate stage shows. I don't just turn up and like read from the book and answer questions or be in conversation with somebody. I kind of really make it a show. With Psychopath Night, I'd have mystery guests and so on. With The Castle, I'm going to be having like loads of clips, like audio, like almost like a sort of collage of how I went about, you know, the adventure that ended up as the book. So it's going to feel much more like a sort of multimedia show. So I'm working on that, and I'm working on Things Fell Apart, and that's kind of all I'm doing between now and the autumn. And then in the autumn, I'm just going to be talking about The Castle nonstop, and then Things Fell Apart will come out. That's my year.
And one final question I always ask guests on the show, is there an album from the last 12 months that you would recommend to our listeners? It can be new, it can be old.
I think I've mentioned it twice. I'm going to go for Doechii. I think the album Alligator Bites Never Heal by Doechii is really, really good. I'm saying that because I've been really down a big long Doechii rabbit hole lately. That's the one I'll recommend. Alligator Bites Never Heal. If people want to sort of be eased gently into Doechii, I'd recommend they watch her Tiny Desk concert. Are you a Tiny Desk person?
Yeah, the Geese one is really good.
Okay.
They did it
a couple of weeks ago. I haven't got into Geese yet, I've got to say. I found it difficult to get into. But I loved the Doechii one. I loved Idols. Their Tiny Desk I thought was brilliant. David Burns was very good recently. Olivia Rodrigo's was very good. But yeah, I think if people are Doechii curious, then watch her Tiny Desk, because that's her at her very best, and it's kind of incredible, I think.
Thanks to John Ronson for joining me today. His new book, The Castle, is released on the 20th of August on Penguin Random House and is available from all good bookshops. The Skate Arts Club Night is back on Saturday, the 22nd of August at the Shackle Alarms, when our guest DJs are the excellent Walt Disco. Last month was sold out, and the final few tickets are available on Dice. I'll be back next week when my guest is the BAFTA award-winning filmmaker Mark Jenkin. We'll be talking about one of the best films of the year, Rose of Nevada, along with his approach to filmmaking and what draws him to the stories he tells. This podcast was produced at Birdfall Recording.